thank Mrs. El-Mulley for the wonderful opportunity. As well, I want to thank all of you. It's late at night. I want to share with you the following. We'll get into where we're going with this. You know, over the last seven decades, on the decade, the leadership of the Jewish community in America always did the following. There was always a demographic study. Where are the Jews? Who are the Jews? Etc. And that happened for 70 years. In 2010, we were waiting for it to happen, and it wasn't done. Why not? So everyone speculates. The honest truth why it wasn't done? Who wants to share your dirty laundry in public? What are we going to do? We're going to show the world that we're a shrinking people, that essentially what's happening is the impact that we claim to have in Washington for Israel. It's not true. So it wasn't done. We didn't do it. Last year, I don't know if you remember, it was done to us. You know what I'm talking about? Exactly. The Pew Report. By the way, what kind of name is Pew? Pew? You know what Pew is? You know them by a different title. It's a very fine Lutheran family from Philadelphia. They made multiple billions in the following business: Sunoco Oil. Sunoco Oil is a Pew family. So they have a charitable foundation, but what they started was, it's the cutting edge in all of America. If you want to know something about the demography of Americans, gays and lesbians in America, Mormons in America, Muslims in America, who does the study? There's a whole research institute, a foundation that was set up by the Pew family. So guess what? It was our turn last year. They decided to do an analysis of Jews in America. I'm going to start out with the good news. The good news I'm looking at, okay? There's three phenomena that are very positive about the Orthodox community. Number one, do you know that of us, our families, our communities, 29 out of 100 did not grow up in an Orthodox home. 12 of us grew up conservative. 8 of us grew up Reform. 2 of us converted to Judaism, were Jews by choice. 8% of us grew up in a home with no affiliation whatsoever. 29. Can you imagine what our community would be like without that 30%, without that influx? Just to give you an example. The Catholics in America have a big problem. What's the problem the Catholics have? 1 out of every 10 Americans is a lapsed Catholic. It's people who've left Catholicism, and there's no one coming in. We've been, as an Orthodox community, we've been blessed with that 29% influx. The second piece of good news, we said there was no macro study of American Jewry. There were three cities that did a study of themselves. Now, I'm guessing probably some of you are from the tri-state area. Yeah? New York in 2013, the Federation did a study of itself. Let's take the Orthodox out. Okay. The average Jewish woman in New York, New York means the 5 boroughs, Nassau County and Westchester County. That's what they defined as New York. The average woman has 1.2 children. Do you understand for a couple, just to reproduce yourselves, you have to have 2.2 children? That's before any intermarriage, any assimilation. We're a dying people. The Orthodox we pulled out, and we should thank the Hasidim for this. The Orthodox Jewish woman in New York area, 4.45 children. So not only do we have the influx of 29% of us didn't grow up in an Orthodox home, but there's a huge geometric growth rate. That's the second piece that's very exciting. The third, and this is fascinating. In 1960, I think before any of us were here, 1960, there was a magazine in America called Look. Look would be the equivalent of People, Us magazine, Life magazine. Look did a study on Jews in America, like an expose on the Jews in America. And in that study, they quoted a professor of sociology from Harvard University. You know what he said? By the year 2020, meaning in 60 years from now, by the year 2020, the Orthodox Jew in America will be an extinct species. There'll be an Orthodox Jew in Israel, but in America will be extinct. And you want to know something? If you and I were there in 1960, we would have agreed with them. What changed? something called the day school movement. The yeshiva day school movement is what changed. And let me share with you what we saw from the Pew. Jews who today are in their 70s, 80s, or 90s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, they grew up in a home that was affiliated Orthodox. The retention rate today is 22%. That means 22 out of 100 of them are still Orthodox. Do you understand, if you only retain 22% of your clients, if you only retain 22% of your customers, not only would you be bankrupt, you would have been bankrupt a decade ago. What happened? And the chief demographer of the Pew, he shared this with me. As you get younger and younger and younger, 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s. Now, by the way, you are the youngest demography that the Pew studies. 18 to 29 is the youngest group. They won't. They only will study people they can interview and have discussions with. So it doesn't include anyone under 18. Your group has an 83% retention rate. Now, amongst us privately, that's embarrassing. But to them, that's astounding. Chances are it's really better than 83%, because a lot of your peers, they may go off the derech in college, in graduate school, as singles. You know when most Orthodox Jews, day school graduates, come back? Not even so much when they get married, but when they have kids. And they look back, all along, you know, I don't like this about the school, I didn't like this about my yeshiva education, I didn't like this about the shul. And I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying day school education or our shuls are perfect. But what happens is when you have to raise children, all of a sudden you start to appreciate community. What it's like for it to have a community, for them to have friends, to be doing things, etc. And it's not so bad. So a lot of them come back. But let's go with the 83%. Nowhere, not in any demographic group, forget Jews, anywhere, do you go from such a miserable retention rate to such an astounding retention rate. So those three phenomena, we're keeping our people, there's a huge influx, 29%, and we're having a geometric growth rate. We're having more children than other Americans. I mean, just to give you an example, many of you have heard that many countries in Europe are going to become Muslim. That's absolutely correct. White Christian Europe, I'm talking about Italy, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, they're having between 1.4 and 1.6 children per woman. By 2070, Belgium, France, and Netherlands, unless something changes drastically, by 2070, those will be Muslim countries. It's just simple math. We're growing. So here's my question to you. What should be our response to all that good news? 29% influx, 4.4 children, you know, 83% retention. You know what I think our response should be? While Rome burnt. While Rome burnt! Shame on us. And I'm going to ask something of you. Don't make the mistake that my generation did. Learn from my flaws, my generation's flaws. You know what my generation did? And we had the sincerest of intentions. You know what we did? We didn't have second homes. We didn't go on vacations. We put our money into our institutions, into our kids' education. We wanted our children should have a better day school education than we had to build up the yeshivas. We wanted our children should go to Israel for a year or 2 years. We wanted that our children should make aliyah. And if they come back, that they should be pillars and strong in the community. And we wanted to give them camping experiences, day school experiences, have nice mikvahs for our women, kosher restaurants. And we put all of our energy into building this infrastructure. And we did a decent job. Don't get me wrong. We have mistakes. Our schools are not perfect. Our shuls are not perfect. Don't get me wrong. But we've made it a better opportunity for our kids than we had. And you know what we did? You know what our flaw was? Our mistake? We became absolutely irrelevant. We became irrelevant to the majority of American Jewry. Because everybody says Lakewood or Muncie's a ghetto. You know what we did? Teaneck is a ghetto. Five Towns is a ghetto. Skokie is a ghetto. And isn't it nice at a place like Teaneck? You can go to the chocolate shul. You can go to the strawberry shul. Everyone's just like you. You can go to the mint chocolate chip shul. Everyone's just like you. Shame on us. We became irrelevant to the rest of American Jewry. And I'm asking you not to make our mistake. Let me share with you the other side of the pew. Take the Orthodox out of it. Do you know that 71.5% of every 100 people are getting married in America, Jews getting married in America, are marrying someone who's not just not Jewish, someone who doesn't identify as a Jew. No interest in a conversion, no interest in being part of the Jewish people. Meaning, they identify as either a Muslim, a Lutheran, a Methodist, a Baptist, a Catholic, a Mormon. Now you add in non-halachic conversions. You're talking over 80% of the non-Orthodox community. You know, when I grew up, I'll tell you three things about what American Jewry looked like. The largest block of American Jews were conservative Jews. Almost all Jews gave to their local federation campaign. And the largest youth group in America was BBYO. You know why BBYO? No self-respecting Jewish kid would be caught dead in a temple, a synagogue, a shul. And what did Nifty and NCSY and B'nai Akiva and USY do? They stuck to the affiliate. Where was BBYO? BBYO was smart. They went to the JCC. Jewish kids would go to the JCC. And they were the largest group. Today, we're the largest group. Why are we the largest group? So Mira Spivak just came in. She runs JSU clubs in public schools throughout Portland and Eugene, Oregon. We have about 230 of these clubs in public schools throughout the length and breadth of North America. Atlanta has 8. The Valley, the city in Orange County has 32. You have it in Oakland and Phoenix and Vegas, multiple clubs in Kansas City, you name it, Midwest, Atlantic Seaboard, throughout Florida, Jacksonville, Southern Florida. Why? Because today, a typical American Jew, your age, I'll be honest with you, it's not just your age. It's 45 and below. But your age, let me give you the typical American Jew, unaffiliated. You add up all the Reform, all the conservative, all the Orthodox, put them together. We're a minority. The body of American Jewry is unaffiliated. Your peers, not only are they unaffiliated, a couple of things. Most of them have not had a bat mitzvah. All of them cannot read Hebrew. Most of them can't even identify Hebrew letters. Like if you'd show on a card, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, they couldn't tell you this is a Gimel, this is a Bet. Can't do that. They're not anti-Jewish. They're not negative about Judaism. The Pew showed that. They are very negative about Israel. And that's a tragedy. What happens? Most of them grow up in a progressive liberal home. It's not bad, it's not negative if you grow up in a progressive liberal home. However, if you do, the images you see, you're not watching Fox News. In your house, MSNBC is on, which does a horrific job of communicating Israel and analyzing it and reporting on Israel. On your iPhone, on your smartphone, the pictures you see from Israel are very negative. The blogs you read are negative. I'll give you a statistic from the Pew. Your demographic, the 18 to 29-year-old, unaffiliated, which is the largest block, they ask, what factor is significant in being Jewish? What is a significant factor to you? And you'll be happy to hear this. Jerry Seinfeld is more popular than the Holocaust or Israel. 73% said having a sense of humor. 68% said the Holocaust. 29, you talk about an underwhelming statement, 29% said Israel. I mean, that's terrible. What happens is, they took a small group of them. Those unaffiliated Jews, unaffiliated, who've been to Israel once, now can you explain to me why an unaffiliated Jew would have been in Israel? Obviously there's one reason. Exactly, the birthright. So the birthright's not perfect. But what did the birthright do? That 29% became 64%. 10 days, to be honest with you, it's 9 days in Israel. 9 days in Israel, and it skyrocketed that Israel's significant in what it means to be a Jew. So when they get here, they see. It's not a wall. It's not an apartheid state. We don't cage in Palestinian children like rats and prevent them freedom of movement. That's not what we do. It was a fence that saved thousands of lives. Oh yeah, and the 443, when people were commuting to work to Tel Aviv or Yerushalayim, when the Palestinians were shooting at motorists, so they had to put up a wall. When they're here, they see it, and they get it, and they meet the people. But what? The unaffiliated is the dominating force in American Jewry. The reason that Meira and many others like her are in the public schools is because that's where you get the kids. And why, what do you, I mean, you know how I'm choking what I'm going to tell you right now. The OU is the largest consumer of Starbucks products. Not everything is kosher, but many of the drinks are. Why, they don't even have an OU Ashgacha. Why are we in Starbucks? You know why we're in Starbucks? Because like the kids when I grew up that wouldn't go to the temple, the synagogue, the shul, these kids aren't going to a JCC. There's a psychological inhibition. They're not going to a JCC. So where are you going to take them? Where they feel comfortable. Starbucks. You can learn about Purim and you can learn about Hanukkah in the school, but there's church-state boundaries. You can't do the theology of Hanukkah and Purim. Where are you going to teach the theology of Hanukkah and Purim? In Starbucks. Now, what can you do that's different than what we did? And I'm going to make the following statement. Okay. You're much more powerful than I am. You know why you're more powerful than I am? You don't have a title. I have this title, Rabbi, in front. If I was just Steve Weil, I'd be more powerful. What happens, Rabbi? So they have respect for a rabbi, like a priest, a minister, a rabbi. You know, they have respect for a rabbi. But you're a professional Jew. You're paid to be a Jew. So they can't relate to you. You're not. You're a peer. It might be your cousin. It might be a neighbor. It might be the son or daughter of somebody who works with your parents or works for your parents or one of your parents' clients. You're a peer. You're natural. You're normal. It's organic Judaism with you. And you're not an official Jew. That's why you're much more powerful. And I'm going to become very trite. For the next 10, 12 minutes, just allow me to give very concrete, specific examples of what the power you have. I'm going to ask you something that's going to sound ridiculous at first, but I just ask you to think about this request. In your homes, I would ask this. Don't invite each other over Friday night. Shabbos lunch, have frum people over. Dedicate every Friday night to only inviting people who wouldn't have a Friday night dinner, would not be having a Shabbos meal, a Shabbat dinner. No candles, no kiddush, no nothing. You know what they're going to see in your house? Or if it's at the college, at your dorm, you know what they're going to see? Something that you take for granted every Friday night, and it will blow them away. Number one, they're going to get a 4 or 5 course meal. Do you know in America, the only place you get a 4 or 5 course meal is a wedding. And they come to your house and they're getting it. I'm not saying we're going to put you on Top Chef, but it's pretty impressive. Number two, they're going to see a family that sings together. And I'm not calling you the Von Trapp family singers, but a family that sings together, whether it's Zmiros or Shalom Aleichem or Shir Malos. Number three, and I'm not saying that this would be true on Wednesday night, but on Friday night, what happens in your home? You guys make eye contact with each other. You read each other's body language. Why? Because there's no iPhone. There's no smartphone. There's no technology. In America today, we don't connect with each other. Socially, we don't connect. We're busy electronically being connected to each other. And they're coming to a home where people read their eyes and make body language with them. There's a real social connectivity. Something else. I'm not saying you don't make small talk. But one thing that I will say, at your tables, part of the discussion is substantive. It might be the Ramban who brought up an issue in this week's Parsha. It might be a debate between the Ramban and the Rambam on a certain issue. It might be the following. A discussion about what happens if the P5+1 signs this horrific agreement with Iran and they leave a nuclear infrastructure existing there, without the ability to have checks at any point in time on military installations, where most of this was developed until this point. What will that mean for the world? And you'll talk about the fact but the Saudis, the Turks, the United Arab Emirates are all on record saying if they have nuclear capability, we go nuclear. We'll go to the same Pakistani nuclear physicists, and we can't live in a world where they have that capability. You'll talk about those things. To most Americans, and I include American Jews, what's Yemen? They can't even find it on a world atlas. You know what happens with you? What's happening in the world, because you see the world as a Jew, through the eyes of a Jew, you understand that narrow little strait where the Red Sea goes into the Gulf of Aden, you know full well 35% of the world's oil, 35% of the world's energy resources could be shut down by the Iranian Navy that's there. The Iranian Republican Guard now is supporting the Houthis. We're back in the 8th century. We're going to have a war between the Shia and the Sunni. And the Saudis have no choice. They're not a battle-tested army. They've got their military there. They've got all the most sophisticated American weaponry, F-16s, ICBMs, and the Iranians have sophisticated Russian weaponry. We could have World War III yesterday. We could have World War III tomorrow. Yemen is not irrelevant. Yemen is going to affect the world. You get that. And you talk about those things. You talk about a Ramban. You talk about an idea from Rabbi Soloveitchik, from Rav Huttner. You talk about some of the concepts that you've learned here. Yeah, you might talk about Angelina and what tattoo she had this week. You might have done a little bit of that nonsense too. But you're substantive people. They're blown away by that. And you take it for granted. You have no idea the power you have. I'm going to be trite for the next few minutes. Purim Suda. Don't invite foreign Jews over for Purim. Invite a non-observant Jew. Let them see how fun and how beautiful our religion is. What are they going to see besides getting a great meal from you? People are going to be knocking at your door, showing up in costume. You know what they think Judaism is? It's all about the Holocaust and saying Kaddish, which they can't even say. Something else. How much does it cost to send someone your age, 18 to 26? What's the cost to send someone on a birthright trip? What is it? Anyone? Exactly. Two big Dunkin' Donuts. We're in Israel. Two big Sufganiyot. It's nothing. It costs nothing. Now, again, not every birthright is perfect. We, this year, with the war, we sent 2,700 unaffiliated kids, what's called Israel Free Spirit. We run Israel Free Spirit as a birthright for non-from kids. And we give them Yiddishkeit. I would hope you'd push into that. But I will tell you, the Hillel birthrights, no, they're not from, but they're very good. They take somebody and they work with them and they give them an educational program, they give them a meaningful Shabbos experience, and then there's follow through afterwards. Some of the birthrights are not great. I gotta tell you, some of the birthrights, it's three bar nights, one in Eilat, Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, two beach afternoons. It's one big, I'll leave out the description. But not everyone's going to get turned on by a birthright. But I've already quoted you some of the statistics, the positive benefits of a birthright. And it could be, if they elongate their trip in Israel, we found that statistically, if they extend their trip, which they can do at no extra cost, they can change their flight, that's part of the arrangement the birthright has with El Al. What happens is, they could go to a yeshiva, they could go to a program, and it could really make all the difference. Something else. We all give presents. Someone does you a favor, we all give presents, correct? So what do? A box of Godiva chocolates, an interesting bottle of single malt scotch. I would ask you to do this. Give them books, Jewish books, that they could relate to, appreciate. I'm going to suggest a couple. See, it's one thing to preach. Americans don't like to be preached to. Americans do like to be stimulated, though. I have a friend. You've all heard this man's name. Former chief rabbi Jonathan Sacks. Right? I have a relationship with the Lord. Let me tell you something he shared with me. He said to me, I want to tell you something about me. He says, they call me the chief rabbi of the Jews. He says, the honest truth is, you know what I really am? I'm the chief rabbi of the Goyim. That's what he said. I said, what do you mean by that? He says, well, do you know anything about British Jewry? I said, not a lot. He said, the Haredi community in Britain, they think I'm a shagetz. They do not hold for me. The liberal community in Britain, which is the Reform Jews, the equivalent of the Reform Jews. They really despise me. Why? They think that I'm a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because here I am, this professor with a fancy Oxford English, a proper British diction, and they think that all I'm doing is camouflaging a barbaric, antiquated religion with antiquated practices in Oxford English. So they really despise me. So who am I the rabbi of? What's called the United Synagogue. Now, the United Synagogue has a number of shuls in the suburbs of London that are very dynamic. They're like our shuls. A lot of learning going on, chesed, pro-Israel activism, a lot of minyanim, great places. Most United Synagogue shuls, with the exception of 3 days a year, you could hear a pin drop. They're empty. There's no one there. She said, I go to Edinburgh, I go to Glasgow, I go to these places, and I'm talking to air. No one there. If I'm their rabbi, how am I supposed to communicate with them? So you know what he said he did? He used the BBC. He used the Guardian. He used the web to communicate ideas in Judaism. And what happened? The Goyim, the Gentiles. Their religious figurehead is a man known as the Archbishop of Canterbury. The Archbishop of Canterbury, what did he do? In order to be PC, he made religion fit into the flavor of the month of Western civilization. Every new whim and desire of Western civilization, well, religion really follows that. People had no respect for that psychobabble. Jonathan Sacks, what did he do? He made the case for religion. Here's the thing, though. If you're Rebbeim, if Mrs. El-Maleh gets up and she quotes the Ramban, you know what happens? You give it weight. You sitting there realize, hey, the Ramban is a spiritual giant. He's an intellectual giant. If she quotes Ovadia Sipporno, Rabbi Goldsmith, let's say he'll quote the Ksav HaKabbalah or the Netziv, right away, you perk up. These are Balei HaMesora. What happens? That doesn't speak. They never heard the Netziv. They can't pronounce what's Nachmanides. There's some short guy who lived in medieval Spain. What does that have to do with me? So Jonathan Sacks had to make the case for religion using secular knowledge, secular terminology, where they're coming from. The book is called A Letter in the Scroll. A Letter in the Scroll. You read it?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I would recommend giving that to your peers your age. Now, I may be dating myself, okay? But there's a book that was written. It was a different time in their life. Joseph Telushkin and Dennis Prager wrote a book called The Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism. That speaks to a secular person. It makes the case for Judaism. Wow.
See, you know, it's always good for a speaker to have props.
Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism. Give Jewish books. Give a Kiddush and Avdalah scent. I was very trite. Whether it's a Purim Suda, whether it's Mishloach Manos. You know, everybody says in our community there's a problem with alcohol, there's a problem with drugs. We have a much bigger problem in our community. You know what the problem is? We eat too much. Diabetes is our problem, not alcohol and drugs. You know what? It's 4 weeks before Pesach. We're all going to put on between 6 and 10 pounds just a month away. Do we have to give everybody in the shul Mishloach Manos, or God forbid they won't talk to us? Give your Mishloach Manot. First of all, they can't pronounce it. They think it's a town in Poland that your grandmother's from. Okay? Give them Mishloach Manot. They're going to be blown away. They get a beautiful basket of food with a wonderful card in it. You'll make, not their day, you'll make their week. And we all have neighbors. We all have cousins. We all have people at work. We all have people that we know that fit that bill. Now, let's come back to you. You know what you are? No, you may not know all the Rishonim on Chumash. You may not know all the Midrashim. You may not know the Mishnah Berurah Kol. But you know what every one of you in this room is? Your knowledge is 10,000 times. It's 10,000 times that of an unaffiliated Jew. And you know what you are? You're natural in your Judaism. There's nothing wrong when somebody asks you a question with not having the answer. Don't try to make up an answer. Say, you know what? That is a great question. And I don't have a good answer for that. Or that is a great question and I struggle. I'm also bothered by that question.
But I'm going to work on it. I'm going to see, you know, I'm going to see how some of the greats struggle with this. People respect that. But you know what you are? You're an American who lives in Western civilization. You're sophisticated. You're educated. You're normal and natural. And you know what you are at the same time? You're comfortable in your own skin as a Jew. Judaism is organic to you. Judaism is natural to you. And you have no idea the impact you can have. You have no idea. And I would ask you the following. We have this network. 11,000 kids in the network. Majority of them unaffiliated, minority reform, small minority conservative. But it's primarily unaffiliated. We don't have enough role models. We don't have enough advisors. What's an advisor do? It might be you're with them on a Shabbaton. It might be that you reach out to them and you have a Skype chavruta. It might be that you invite them to your home. It might be that you text them. You tweet them. But to have, see, because there's another thing you are that they don't, you know, they don't see. They may have gadgets and they may have stimuli in their life that are much more dynamic, interesting, sexy than you are. I don't mean that in the literal sense. I mean, you know, in the dynamic sense, you know, keeps their ADHD going. But one thing you have that they don't, you're real. You're sincere. You're sincere, you're real, and you care. For a high school kid to have somebody who's 20 or 19 or 21 that cares about them for who they are, not for an agenda, not for an ulterior motive, just because it's one Jew to another Jew, that blows them away. It blows them away as much as that Friday night dinner. And we need you. I was blessed that I had a daughter who went to Shalavim. Okay? I was blessed by that. Her friends, 4 years later, are her Shalavim friends. They're friends for life. There was something special about that year that shaped them. Yeah, they came from a house of a religious family. They came from a house, rabbi's daughter, everything else. It was Shalavim that shaped her. And you all have had that experience this year. And one thing about the women of Shalavim, when they go back to America, and I'm not saying you should all go back, l'chatchila, stay in Israel. Here, you can make a difference. But if you decide to go back, there's something natural about you, there's something healthy about you, that you are amazing role models. Not by being a teacher, not by being a preacher, your role model is just being yourself, just being who you are. And something else, we all know that before she would say it when it comes to giving to tzedakah, v'nasnu, so I'm going to take the shorish, natan, nasan. It's a palindrome. You know what a palindrome is? The more you give, it's the giver who gains. The one who's giving is the one who's really getting. And as much as you'll change their life, you'll be role models to them, you'll have an impact on them, as much as that's all true, being a giver makes a Jew. If you had to define what a Jew is someone who's inherently a giver, not a taker. And you have so much to give by being yourself, just by being natural. We need you. We really need you. And you can make a world of difference. And I want to go back to where I started from. My generation, we didn't do it with malice. It wasn't premeditated. But we have become irrelevant to the greater Jewish community. Learn from our generation's mistakes. Stephen Cohn, and this is where I'm going to end. Do you know who Professor Stephen Cohn is? Professor Stephen Cohn was the chief consultant on the Pew. He is the premier demographer of the Jewish people. Just to give you his background, he's not Orthodox. He runs a graduate program at NYU. He's on staff at Hebrew Union College, the Reform Seminary. I took our senior staff to meet with Professor Cohn after the Pew came out. We spent the day with him. And then I had Professor Cohn give a webinar to the Orthodox rabbinate, all the Orthodox rabbis throughout North America. And he said the following. I'm going to quote him. That's where I'm going to end. He said, look, I want you to know what I tell you now on this webinar, I say it behind your back. I tell it to the Reform, the conservative, and I tell it to the unaffiliated. We can't change what's happening in America without the Orthodox. Only with the help of the Orthodox can we change this. And I'm telling you, you won't stop all 71 and a half. But if you really cared as a community, not as individuals, but as a community, if you cared about this the way we care about a nuclear Iran, the way we care about other things, you could stop 10 and probably 15%. Of the 71 and a half who's marrying someone who under no circumstances is a Jew, they don't think they're a Jew, they don't want to have anything to do with Judaism, they're just marrying a Jewish guy or a Jewish girl, you could stop 10 to 15% of those Jews from doing that. He says, let me speak to you as a demographer. Do you know what 10 to 15% of that population is? If you look at their grandchildren, which is not that far away, their grandchildren, that translates into 100,000 Jews. We all know. Kol ha-mekayim nefesh achas, ki'ilu ki'yem olam mole, one life, one Jew is a universe. We, if we cared about this, we could save 100,000 Jews. And I think you can do it. And we need you. Our organization that Mira and I work for, we are condemned by our own people, by the Orthodox community. You know why? 70% of the money that we raise philanthropically and 70% of the kashrus revenues goes into this whole network. It's 11,000 of these unaffiliated Jewish teenagers. And they said, you know, put more money into the programs you have to alleviate Jewish education, the 8 state houses we're in. Put more money into Yachad. Put more money into the shuls. We're in 15 development towns where we work with Russian, with Ethiopian, with Sephardic kids. Put more money into Israel. That's our future anyways. And they're very critical of us. And they're right. They have a right to be critical. And you know what our response is? Our response is the following. This population, if we don't get them now, their kids won't be Jewish. We don't have a second shot with their children. Statistics don't lie. If we don't get them, their children won't be Jewish, because they won't be Jewish. And that's why we need you. What we have is, and I want to thank you for your time, and I want to thank Mrs. El Mulley, I want to thank the Rebbeim who stayed late into the night. I would appreciate this very much. What we're going to do, for those who might have an interest, we have these cards. It's a little bit of, you go to a website. It's called ncsy.org advisor info. And you can go there and fill in, you know, where you're going to be next year, if you have an interest in this, you know, who you'd have an interest in. You'll ask some basic questions, you know, that you went to Shalavim in the old days. Do they still call it Shalavot? Okay. That you went to Shalavim for women. You know what I mean? And just give us a little bit about info about yourself. If you have an interest, we would really be grateful. Thank you very much.